This is The Guardian.
After winning a crucial vote in the House of Commons this week, the government is going ahead with its cut to the winter fuel allowance.
The Labour Party's own previous analysis claimed that this policy could cause 3,850 deaths.
Inevitably, there's still huge disquiet and dismay in the Labour Party.
We don't have to be here. I was not elected to impoverish my constituents and put them in this hardship.
And the message from Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves remains the same. Things are going to get worse before they get better. But how's the public going to react to that? And what does it mean for the Labour politicians who want a more hopeful plan for the country? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. On Tuesday, the House of Commons voted on the government's plan to withdraw the £200 to £300 winter fuel allowance from 10 million pensioners. 52 Labour MPs abstained, only one actually rebelled. This cut, so far anyway, is the most controversial measure taken by Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, as she tries to fill what she says is a £22 billion black hole in the public finances. It's fair to say that the move has been deeply unpopular among Labour MPs, and it has to be said, one or two cabinet ministers. And it raises huge questions about the government's approach to taxation and spending and its insistence that things are going to have to get worse before they get better. Caroline Abrahams is charity director for Age UK, and she's been very critical of this policy. First of all, Caroline, just tell me your reaction to the vote on Tuesday.
Well, deeply disappointed by the vote, but not remotely surprised, because as soon as the government made it clear it was going to impose a whip on its members, therefore instructing them to vote in support. Of course, it was inevitable with their big majority that the whole thing was going to go through. And actually, we're really grateful to all the Labour MPs who did actually abstain or who voted against. And I think it took quite a lot of courage to do that. And of course, quite a few just happened not to be available that day and had been allowed to be slipped. I think this is not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the story, really, because as we speak, the weather's going to get colder. The implications for older people on very low incomes of this policy decision are going to start to be felt and to be seen.
You said, you know, you seize the chance whenever it's there to alert people to the likely effects of this. So let's talk about that. What is this winter going to be like for many of the elderly people who you speak to?
Well, if you're an older person on a very low income, then life is already pretty tough. Of course, government likes to point out the importance of the triple lock, and they're right, it's definitely made a difference. But the reason that's gone up largely is because inflation has been so high, and I think everybody knows that you go into the shops and everything costs quite a lot more than it used to. So a lot of that extra income has been eaten up by high prices. So, and we've had year after year of problems, of course, following the pandemic, the cost of living crisis. So there are some older people who had some savings, but they've had to run them down. There are other people with no savings at all who are living in cold homes that are expensive to heat. They may be not very well. Perhaps they're disabled. They can't move around to stay warm, or they've got a chronic health condition and they have to keep their home warm in order to control that condition. If you're one of those people, you're looking at losing £200 or £300 and really wondering how you're going to get through the winter. And we know from all our conversations with older people, a lot of them very averse to going into debt, will do anything to avoid going into a debt. And that often means actually rationing their energy use because they're worried about the bill they're going to build up. So that equates to turning down the heating or turning it off and not even trying to keep adequately warm. And that's a big problem for older people because unlike people who are younger, they really do have to stay warm for their health. And again, if you're one of those people with a heart condition, a lung problem, then getting very cold is actually quite dangerous for you.
And you're worried about people dying. You must be.
Yeah, we are. We haven't talked much about that publicly. We haven't wanted to alarm people. And we certainly couldn't put a number on it. But the reality is some people are very frail and unwell at home. And, you know, they need the best possible situation to be able to live well, to thrive. And if that's not there, if their home is very cold, if they're going to become very cold, then yes, I'm afraid their survival is at risk.
And how many people are we talking about here who you are worried about? Of the 10 million from whom the winter fuel allowance has been withdrawn, how many people do you think are going to really, really feel this and have their safety compromised by it?
We think about 2.5 million.
Wow.
Which is quite a large proportion, really, out of the 10.5. And they're people who are either on a very low income, so they are entitled to pension credit but don't claim it. That's one group. Or they're people who are just above the line to claim, usually because they have a tiny occupational pension. And there's an unknown number of people who are maybe on a slightly higher income still, but they're the people I've just talked about who are disabled or they're chronically unwell. And so they have to have the heating on a lot, and that builds up a really high bill. So that's about 2.5 million people in all. And of course, when we talk to older people, a lot of them say to us, oh, we'll be fine. You know, there's somebody much worse than me I'm worried about up the road. That's very often what we hear from older people. But that's them making the best of it, really. And behind that, underneath that, there are a lot of people who I think who really are going to struggle quite badly this winter.
I'm sort of hesitant to ask you this question, but I will. This is one of those classic benefits, it seems to me, that should be universal, right? There is a big place, I think, in the welfare state, and there remains a big place for universal benefits. Means testing is expensive, and a lot of people always end up being the casualties of it. Nonetheless, is there a level of means testing that would mean we weren't talking about 2.5 million pensioners on the rough end of this that you would accept?
Yes, is the honest truth.
Ah, go on.
Yes, because the level for claiming pension credit is actually very low. It's lower than £12,000 a year. And when some clever people did some work recently, the last few years, looking at what would an adequate income be for a pensioner to avoid living in that degree of poverty, they came up with about 14,000. So
right.
The pension credit threshold would have to rise quite considerably if we were going to do that. Or we'd find other ways of actually giving money to people who are at risk through the winter to keep them safe and well.
Here's a bigger sort of cultural question. It seems to me that a lot of people, politicians perhaps, have been sort of softened up in the build-up to this move by the idea, which really seemed to embed itself after the Brexit referendum and so many older people voting for Brexit. Particularly on the political left, there was this idea that pensioners were in a very privileged position. You know, I think there's this idea, which I think is correct, that most pensioners own their houses, but, you know, that leaves open what the value of those houses is. It doesn't mean you're stinking rich. And of course, that the government had and still has a triple lock on pensions and so on. So relative to younger people, pensioners were doing all right. That's definitely in the political culture. And I wonder whether consciously or unconsciously, that was in some people's minds when this measure, which has been proposed for a long time by the Treasury, was accepted and this government put it through. There's something here, isn't there, about how pensioners are seen.
Yeah, there is something here. I think there's lots of things going on here. I think one is traditionally the Treasury doesn't like this sort of benefit because if you take a purely economic perspective, it's economically inefficient to be giving money to people who don't need it, which, of course, is the price you pay.
Yeah.
If you have a universal benefit, it guarantees you get it to all those in need. But the prices you have to give it to those who aren't.
But get onto the pensioners are all rich and own their own houses and are thoroughly mollycoddled and have got really nothing to complain about. I've heard that so much in the last 8 years or so.
Yes, I agree. It's something called the intergenerational narrative. I think at heart, part of what's happened there is that it is true that if you're a middle class young person, life is a lot harder now. It's much harder to have the money to leave home, buy a house, get a good career than it probably was 40 years ago when people's, you know, middle-aged parents were doing that same thing. So life has got harder for middle-class young people, I think, for all sorts of economic and social reasons. And it's so, against that context, it's awfully easy to sort of blame older people. And the book that brought all this to the fore by David Willetts kind of does that, is the honest truth of it, which, of course, is absurd because, you know, someone's granny, it's not her fault that we've had these enormous social and economic shifts.
And just if people want a few further reading tips, David Willetts, the former Tory minister, the book that you mentioned is called what?
Called The Pinch, I think. And he wrote it some years ago. I think there might be one or two follow-ups from that as well. But I think it's worth people remembering that he is obviously a Conservative politician. And I think one of the things that's been unfortunate about his narrative is that it has split people on the left into thinking more that the enemy is, you know, older people or younger people rather than people who are, you know, rich as opposed to poor.
Yes.
So I think it has been pretty unhelpful. And there's a rebalancing that's needed, of course.
Last question. Since she became Chancellor, or actually before that, have you had any dealings with Rachel Reeves? about this subject or any other?
Not since she became Chancellor. We did write to her a couple of weeks ago. Haven't actually had a response to that. We look forward to a response. We had one meeting with Treasury officials, which was a rather formulaic meeting, as you might imagine, very soon after the announcement. But apart from that, we've heard very little from the Treasury.
This is interesting. Hold on. Pause that. You said you had a meeting with Treasury officials, yep. Did you say?
We did.
That was very formulaic. Just explain what you mean.
What I mean by that is that I think they'd probably been instructed to meet with us. It was all very civilised and pleasant, but actually, obviously, their job is to carry forward the government's policy with which we disagreed. So from that point of view, it was perfectly friendly. But I'm not sure it really served very much point.
Is that a bit like when the teacher used to come round at school dinners and say, any complaints? And you knew full well that even if you did complain, you'd still get the same school dinner. It was one of those occasions.
It was a little bit like that, yes. Albeit conducted in very good spirit, I think, by all concerned. But yes, it didn't really take us or, I suspect, them very much further forward. So no, we haven't had any serious conversation with either the Chancellor, any of her team, or indeed any of her advisers. For me, what I would like to see the Chancellor doing, as well as making some mitigations in the budget, is to use the spending review that she's holding next year to do a proper review of all the money that's going to older people. Because I think what that would show is that some of it is going to people who are better off and who could do with less. But they're at the bottom of the pile. There are lots and lots of older people who need more help. And I think there is a need for a bit of rebalancing there. And the spending review is a really good opportunity to look at that objectively. Part of the problem with this announcement is it was a huge rush. So there's not been time to do any of the things we and others would want to do to support older people to get through this winter. But the spending review in the spring, that's the time to take a more considered look at the future.
Okay, well, we might talk again then. Thank you so much for joining us, Caroline.
Thank you very much.
I'm now joined by The Guardian columnist Raphael Baer. Hello, Raph.
Hello, John.
Thank you for being here. We are going to talk about this specific issue, the cut in the winter fuel allowance, but also the bigger picture, and hopefully we'll get into a number of questions, really, about the heart and soul of this government, if it's got one. Let's talk about what happened on Tuesday. 52 Labour MPs abstained. One Labour MP voted against the government. We should also mention MPs who until recently were Labour MPs but aren't anymore for the foreseeable future. They voted against the government. Labour spin masters said pretty quickly that only 12 of the 52 abstainers were not given leave to abstain. It's true, isn't it, that this rebellion could have been worse for the government?
Oh, it could have been much worse. And actually, I was in Parliament on Monday, and the mood then was quite febrile. There was a sense of a storm brewing, much as you used to get under the last government when big rebellions were coming, and it felt there was a lot of chatter about the government having got itself in a terrible pickle. And then some loyalist MPs were saying, look, you know, we've got some new colleagues. They're not used to getting angry emails being shouted at by pensioners. They're a bit freaked out, but they want to behave themselves. The whips are playing this quite cleverly. It'll probably blow over. Essentially, the media has slightly marched everyone up to the top of a hill about there being a rebellion. And once the vote's done, it'll settle down. And certainly that forecast does look actually quite accurate in terms of what happened, although I think that does sort of understate some of the depth of feeling that really has been going on in the Parliamentary Labour Party.
We'll come on to the depth of feeling. It seems to me, leaving aside the question of the size of the rebellion, there's been a huge sort of failure of communications and political tactics here. See, we now know that from April next year, the state pension is going up by £460, more than this cut. But that news emerged after these long weeks when Rachel Reeves has been trailing the cut in the winter fuel allowance. So they got it the wrong way around in communications terms, didn't they?
I think so. And certainly there is a feeling that the government has made life much harder for itself, probably by foregrounding what it thought was a necessary message of toughness and signalling to one group of people, one audience, that the ministers, the government, were prepared to take these very difficult, harsh decisions without necessarily thinking about the specific segment that was going to be affected by that decision, namely pensioners who get very upset.
But more to the point, you and I both know that the last people very often you want a political fight with are pensioners because, broadly speaking, they all vote. But Reeves just ran into this.
Well, there are a couple of interpretations of this floating around. Means testing winter fuel. I mean, it's very expensive because a lot of essentially very rich pensioners get it. And so you can notionally save money by taking it away from people who really don't need it. And so that's the sort of thing that the Treasury on the Mandarinate side, the officials, will look at and go, well, clearly you can save money here. And every time a chancellor comes in, the Treasury presents it to them and politically astute chancellors go, I'm not doing that because pensioners. And on this occasion, Rachel Reeves, for whatever reason, didn't have, you know, her antennae or the government antennae didn't quite pick that up.
Is it relevant that they're wet behind the ears? I mean, Rachel Reeves certainly is. So is Keir Starmer, right? They haven't been in government before.
Well, you know, I put that to MPs who want to be very supportive of the government and they recoil from the charge saying, Rachel Reeves, you know, she's thought about it a lot. She's very serious and sensible. And, you know, do you seriously think they haven't sort of war gamed all this and worked it out? But ultimately, it does have quite a strong feel of that. You can do a lot of preparation in opposition, and then the sheer frenetic pace at which government moves and how difficult it is, especially when you're Labour and you've got the whole of the Conservative press doing a job that even a debilitated Tory opposition can't necessarily do for them, that can just overtake you much faster than you expected when you're in opposition.
A Conservative press, let's not forget, that speaks for and to older people, by and large. You talked about the depth of feeling among Labour MPs. Just a quick flavour of this. Let's have a listen. Actually, he's not a Labour MP at the moment. I think he's had the whip withdrawn, but I still think it was a Labour MP. Let's have a quick listen to what John McDonnell said in the House of Commons.
We don't have to be here. And I just hope people learn the lesson as we move towards this budget, not to put us in this position again, where we take a decision which is based upon, I believe, misjudgment, and certainly flies against everything I believe in as a Labour MP about tackling inequality and poverty within our society. I was not elected to impoverish my constituents and put them in this hardship.
I mean, it's no surprise that John McDonnell says that as eloquently as he does. MPs further towards the sort of centre of the Labour Party, I would imagine, are feeling a mixture of anger and worry, notwithstanding the fact the rebellion was relatively small, about the fact that any honeymoon period, I mean, God knows, it only lasted a matter of, what, about 10 days, is long gone. It's been reported, very credibly, that Rachel Reeves has told ministers and civil servants to come up with departmental cuts by this Friday in advance of the budget. So we both know there's a bigger picture here, right? And now that budget is coming into view, the mood has been set. Keir Starmer sort of announced the end of the summer by saying things are going to get worse before we get better. That's what he said. So there must be a sense in the Parliamentary Labour Party that it's going to be grim for quite a while.
Well, it is. I mean, that's a very realistic appraisal of the situation. Look, I would go back to this point, though, that for an awful lot of Labour MPs, especially the newly elected ones who have come from the charity sector, sometimes from local government, from all sorts of walks of life, where they have for quite a long time been, crudely speaking, on the side of righteous indignation and virtue, complaining about things that a Conservative government does. And it is just quite a new and shocking experience to be the government being the bad guys doing the mean thing. Now, separately, you can argue whether or not this particular measure is the right one, but governments are going to do that sort of stuff and MPs are going to be hated for it. On top of that, in this case, a group of people, you know, not just pensioners who really need their winter fuel payment, but just, you know, older voters generally who voted Labour for the first time, because traditionally that demographic does vote Conservative, but they were so determined to get the Tories out. And what one person said to me earlier in the week, look, it's nothing like the kind of the tuition fees thing that happened to the Lib Dems at the beginning of the coalition, but it's got a slight whiff of that, of people saying, look, you know what, for the first time ever, I thought, well, you know what, I'm going to give my vote to the Labour Party because I've just got to get these Tories out. And then immediately you turn around and you poke me in the eye with this thing. And that is a bit upsetting for Labour MPs, and that does freak them out.
Right, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be getting into one of my pet theories about two very distinct strands in this Labour government and how those strands are playing out. Welcome back. Here we are in the things are going to get worse before they get better moment. And I feel personally like in the most basic terms, I understand the sort of shape or the makeup of this government, this new government. Two strands, it seems to me, are absolutely central to what's going on. There's one strand which is identifiably of the political centre-left, Social Democrats, for want of a better phrase, people like Angela Rayner, Lisa Nandy, Ed Miliband, Louise Hay, the Transport Secretary, their priorities, you can see them because the government's got proposals that it's going to legislate for to improve people's rights at work, to gradually renationalise the railways, re-regulate local buses, create a new publicly owned energy company. This is all well-intentioned, clearly left of centre stuff that reminds people that the Tories are no longer in charge. Okay, we take that as read. Now, there's a second strand in the government, which I think is more powerful than the one I've just mentioned, which is represented chiefly by Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer. And it seems to me that they're bureaucrats, right? I mean, Keir Starmer is, he's a career bureaucrat. He used to be the Director of Public Prosecutions. Rachel Reeves began her working life as an economist at the Bank of England. They have more power. And it seems to me that their chief concern is fixing the government machine and being seen as competent. And that agenda explains why the former senior civil servant, Sue Gray, is a sort of towering presence in the Starmer administration. And as part of that quest to sort of put the government machine the right way up, the key thing that they're focused on is balancing the government budget while not doing anything bold or imaginative on tax, right? They want to restore the machine as was, get it working again, and they hope, and I'm not sure how they're going to do this, in the process, spark economic growth, right? And there's not much ideological content to that. It's not very left of centre. I don't think it has a particularly powerful vision of the good society, but there it is. What do you think of that theory, Raf, that's broadly speaking, this government takes in those two strands and they're in a very sort of uneasy alliance at the moment?
I definitely recognise that distinction, and I think it's a useful frame for looking at conflicting tensions or competing priorities within the government. I would nuance it in a couple of ways. First of all, Keir Starmer brought an iron grip to the Labour Party and the Shadow Cabinet. So if Ed Miliband has an agenda to set up GB Energy, which he does, and although he doesn't have quite as much money as he might have hoped a couple of years ago, he has a lot more money than other cabinet ministers. So that settlement was done with Rachel Reeves before the budget. So he does actually have quite free hands to do this stuff. He was given that by Keir Starmer.
Right,
so,
right. But that's the uneasy alliance. It's not that they're daggers drawn all the time, right?
No,
but
absolutely.
But they also took his £28 billion of green investment money each year away, right? So it's not like there hasn't been something of a confrontation between those elements.
Yeah, I'm not denying that there is a tension between the different priorities. That's always the case with government. It is important, and I think, you know, this is where Sue Gray comes in, to understand that you can't do anything. You know, you can't do whatever it is, you know, Louise Hay or Ed Miliband or Angela Rayner wants to do unless you have quite a good understanding of actually which levers in number 10 do and don't work and how the Whitehall machine works. And so ultimately, yeah, there is a sequencing thing here, and getting a grip of that and actually delivering basic competent government is quite important. And someone who's sort of well plugged in on the inside of this and not necessarily, you know, overly determined to be loyal to Keir Starmer, but I think prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt, said to me, look, the reality is they thought the election was going to be in the autumn. And if it had been, they would have been way readier for all this stuff. And a lot of the mistakes they're making now are simply a function of it all happening a few months too early. That's maybe a bit too generous. The thing I would say on the fiscal point, which I think is really important, is here you have to distinguish between a political choice that was made as part of the strategy to get out of opposition and into government, which is that you essentially had to acquiesce to these eye-wateringly tight, brutal, and totally artificially austere Tory spending parameters in order to signal to a bunch of voters that Labour can be trusted with public money and are not habitually profligate. Now, a load of people say, you were going to win by a mile anyway. You completely pointlessly walked into that trap and now you've tied your hands and you're going to pay the price for it. And a lot of other people who were involved in the campaign will say, you have no idea how toxic the whole Labour spends your money and doesn't know what to do with it and basically, you know, wheeze it up the wall thing still is for an awful lot of voters. And also, we don't have the counterfactual where Labour won with a massive majority having promised to raise income tax or not do Jeremy Hunt's national insurance.
Yeah, I think some of that can be overstated. So I've read off the record briefings from senior Labour people recently saying people voted for us because we said we'd get the public finances back to rights and by implication stay within Tory spending limits. Now, I don't think that's true. When I was touring the country talking to voters, I didn't meet a single person who said I'm voting Labour because they're going to get the public finances back in balance within Tory constraints. They said, I want the country to change. And they said the health service is falling down and there's litter in the streets where I live and I can't get a bus anywhere and therefore I'm voting Labour, right? So in that sense, there are tensions here which the government position doesn't
absolutely account. But you and I both know that whenever it comes to a choice that people make to vote for any party, it's not the individual notes they listen to, it's the chord. And the fact that some of those base notes of Labour can be trusted with your money, aren't just going to raise taxes on everything, and entirely denied the Conservatives the opportunity to run the campaign they really wanted to run, were a big part. But look, I'm not going to pretend that it was a brilliant idea for Rachel Reeves to essentially put in a position where she can't now reverse Jeremy Hunt's national insurance tax cuts.
Yeah.
If she could, she would have a load more money, and clearly that would make life easier.
Now, let's talk about the politics of all this, right? That this is a moral question about how much more people can take. In 2008, we had the financial crash, and ever since, people have been suffering and going from one crisis to another. All the turbulence around Brexit, then the pandemic, then the cost of living crisis, and now it turns out, contrary to the promise of change and hope, things are not going to get better for a fair while. I wonder what that means for the Labour Party's fortunes.
Yeah, in terms of the question of how much time and how much patience they have to play with, because people are going to get really angry and feel bumping along the bottom already. Yeah, I think that's incredibly dangerous. And I would point to not just the fact that there's about 80 or so seats where Reform are in second place, and so there's a clearly a populist threat from the right there. But what will be interesting to see is as you get rounds of local elections, the Greens, who can very easily attack Labour from a more idealistic left position, saying, well, you know, none of this is necessary and you're just being cruel and you're doing Tory work for them, could start to pick up council seats, could start to make a, you know, to challenge Labour MPs. And then the Labour Parliamentary Party will start to freak out about the threat from the Greens.
I think Labour governments get very nervous about this stuff. In other words, doing something different slightly than what you promised before the election. They get much more nervous about that than Tory governments ever do. I can remember interviewing George Osborne just before the general election of 2010 and asking him what the cuts were going to be. And it was all chicken feed stuff. It was tiny. I don't see in principle why Rachel Reeves couldn't say this is a national emergency. We all know that our public services are falling over, that councils are going bankrupt, that this country's in a terribly shabby state. And therefore, something fiscally, in terms of spending, right, needs to be done. I don't see why that's politically possible. I think this is an emergency. Really, really do, in all sorts of respects.
Yeah, I would go further than that. If that's the plan, and I think, you know, if given that they have put so much political and rhetorical capital and effort into saying, wow, the Tories really messed everything up, it's much worse than we thought, we've opened up the books and it's a right old shambles, this is horrific, which I think is a necessary and important message to deliver, they may already have missed, but they're certainly missing the opportunity to say, and therefore, the national insurance cuts that Jeremy Hunt did look unbelievably reckless. And we simply, we will do them later in the parliament, but we are definitely not doing those now, not yet. And I think that would be, and then the Tories go, oh my God, you lied throughout the campaign. I can't believe you said you weren't going to do that and now you're doing it. I think that would be the screeching, colossal, epic U-turn, you know, of the kind that you sort of think they might be able to get away with, that they should do, possibly.
Yeah, well, the Tories in a position of weakness now, so it would be a good time to do it. We all know what's happening in Europe, the rise of the far right, right? We know about Reform UK, that's been mentioned. You said that they ran Labour second in a lot of old Labour heartlands. We all know what happened over the summer as well. There were riots, racist riots, but racist riots that took place in areas of the country that have, for the last 10 or 15 years, really, really felt the pinch and continue to, right? So just to go back to this point, although, as you say, the government is locked into these decisions, they're full of very, very big risks, and not just standard political risks about helping the opposition, risks of very frightening things happening or intensifying.
I think there is a slightly different problem here that I would identify. I mean, obviously the economics are incredibly important here, but I am generally wary of what Tony Judd, the great social historian described and political theorist, as sort of economism, thinking if you somehow unblock the sluices of distribution, you can wash away the anger that feeds nationalism and populism and far-right sentiment. And actually, although deprivation and collapse of incomes and living standards and stagnation do foment that kind of radical right-wing feeling, you can't then unscramble the eggs by, I'm mixing my metaphors here, by just hosing people with money, even if you had it, that it becomes an
hosing
element of
people with money. But you and I both know, you know, Reform UK doesn't do terribly well in Weybridge in Surrey and Wilmslow in Cheshire, right? And on the Wirral in affluent places, right? It does well where people feel that they are ignored and that things economically are not as they should be, and there's not enough money around, and their public services are falling over. Last question. Do you think Starmer and his people will learn anything from this week?
That's a really interesting question, because my concern is that it exposes a bit of a feature, a bit of a system bug in the Starmer operation, which is that they are so afraid of looking weak that they walk into needless demonstrations of strength that are in fact signs of weakness. Do you know what I mean? And they, the classic, exactly the template of this was going back to a totally different issue, but when he did that LBC interview and he said that basically completely the wrong thing about Gaza, he genuinely misspoke and said something way out of the position that he actually wanted to have. And rather than just going, yeah, we messed that one up, sorry guys, that's clearly not the position. They were so afraid of admitting it was a mistake, they made it 100 times worse by trying to defend the indefensible. And that pattern, that is a bit of a thing. So I worry that what they will learn from this is our MPs need a baptism. Everyone needs to understand how hard this is going to be. And actually, this is good for everyone. And we've just got to power on through, rather than thinking, did we maybe get the comms strategy wrong on this? And actually, are we going in harder and faster than we can get away with politically? I mean, I don't know. I also think there's a conference coming up that is genuinely an opportunity to reset the story and say, okay, here's the sunlit up plans. This is what you've been waiting for. But as we've discussed, I think many times before, it would be remarkable if he did that in a way that sang and cut through. Not going to do it like Barack Obama would do it, let's be honest.
Yeah, no, I think you've pointed up arguably the single biggest problem for the government in terms of the way that it presents itself, which is striding down the street trying to look hard very often means you don't look where you're going. Thank you for joining us, Raf.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Week in the UK wherever you get your podcasts. If you haven't already, please go and listen to our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America. This week, Jonathan Friedland speaks to Rolling Stone magazine's Nikki McCann-Ramirez after the big Harris-Trump TV debate. It's a brilliant analysis of the debate, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.